Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't know a high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons.
It's the love that I find ever since you've been around. Your love put me on the top of the world. Top of the world.
Permit me here and now to promise, as a good comrade and a fellow artist, that I will not report any of this, whatever it is, to the police.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast. Each week, our intrepid group of researchers and music archivists dig through the record crates of the world, finding those albums that may have been lost over time. If a new artist is discovered along the way, well, that's all the better. Using a patent-pending algorithm and spirited debate, we pick one album as an inroad to discuss. Once that is settled, we reach out to the artists and invite them into Thunderlove Studio to chat with your hosts, Keith R. Higgins and Jeff Calhoun. When we're lucky, they say yes. Our mission with Abandoned Albums is simple: to make sure artists' recorded work remains, or in some cases, lands on, the cultural radar. We invite you to sit back and relax. Thank you for joining us.
Well, if you catch me right,
Johnny Manchild is a dynamic and innovative musical artist, best known as the frontman of the Oklahoma-based Johnny Manchild and the Poor Bastards. The band is a unique blend of punk, rock, power pop, and garage rock coupled with elements of classical music, and creates a fusion of genres that defy traditional categorization. Along with his ability to weave complex emotions into his lyrics, Johnny Manchild creates a rich, full-bodied sound that is both innovative and nostalgically familiar. His dedication to his craft and his ability to connect with listeners has cemented his position as a rising talent in the indie music scene. As Johnny Manchild continues to evolve as an artist, his journey reflects a dedication to musical exploration and a refusal to be confined by genre boundaries. His work not only captivates listeners, but also inspires a new generation of musicians to pursue their unique voices in the diverse landscape of modern music. I got the chance to talk with Johnny as he was prepping his new album, Rapture Waltz, and getting ready to go on tour. Here's my conversation with Johnny Manchild.
It's just the normal noises in here.
I don't think I had enough time to prepare. Wow, a lot of stuff here. You got some good work going on.
I'm trying.
You're succeeding from where I sit. I'm going to show you something before we jump into it. These are all the names of artists that I thought might be inspiring you. I'm going to read some of them off to you, and I'm going to read them all off and then tell me if I'm close, way off base, or where I'm at. When I listen to your work, I hear Ben Folds, Billy Joel, Harry Connick, Nathaniel Ratliff and the Night Sweats, the bouncier version of Elton John, some Dave Matthews, some Steely Dan, Michael Bublé, Jamie Cullum, Bruce Springsteen, Prince. In particular, I heard Sade on We, which was really interesting to me.
I don't even know who that is.
Oh, wow. Ah, good. Those are just some of the things, which is not to say that you don't have your own distinct sound, because you do. And I think the closest analogy I'll make is you can't upend the apple cart till you know what the apple cart is made of and is built. Like when you think about Jackson Pollock, if you look at his work, you might think it's just paint splattered on a canvas, but he can't do that unless he knows the history and how to do a still life accurately and all this other sort of stuff. So when I read all those names off to you, those are things that I hear, but I still hear Johnny Manchild.
Well, thank you, first of all. And yeah, you know, I've been, this project has largely been based on piano. That is kind of the centerpiece of the arrangement and everything. And if you're doing anything that is piano or jazz influence mixing into anything alternative or mainstream, you cannot forget about Ben Folds or Billy Joel or Elton John, or, you know, you get jazzy, you're talking about Harry Connick Jr. too. Like, you can't escape those things. Like, it's not, I don't think it matters what you do. You're going to pull from that a little bit.
Right.
Even if you didn't know who they were, I would be shocked if you didn't accidentally steal from them anyway, because they just did so much. There's so much there. And then, yeah, other people that I really dig, I don't fall into the jazz thing. Let me rephrase that. I don't fall into the pop jazz world too much, like the Michael Bublé's. I don't do that whole thing. What I really was taken to is, like, first of all, I grew up on like grunge. I love Queens of the Stone Age. I loved, you know, Green Day and Pavement and The Refreshments and The Replacements. And then, like, there's a lot of that stuff too. It's all there. And what you were talking about too, I've done a few, you know, interviews and podcasts now for this record. And it dawned on me the other day that there's something I've never talked about yet. And so I'm going to talk about it here because it seems
awesome.
The whole thing about, like, Pollock or any artist and, like, knowing the rules before you can break them is a really important thing. I often forget how I'm only 28, but I've just been lucky enough to do a bunch of stuff. And, like, I forget how much time I spent, like, in the practice room. Like, I'm a jazz performance major from the University of Central Oklahoma. That's where I started this project out of. I was also in the Wind Symphony. Like, I toured Germany playing David Maslanka's Symphony No. 9. I was, like, a percussion player with them. I was in the Army band for 5 years. And so, like, I think, like, that is one thing. It's also why I think I'm such a hard critic of myself, is because I am such a fan of music in so many different ways that, like, it has to be interesting to me. And I blend a lot of things. And I just now noticed that said Johnny Manchild and the Bad Seeds. And oh my God, Nick Cave is another huge influence.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Murder Ballads was a record that, like, shaped me as a kid. I loved that record. Probably shouldn't have been listening to it, but I was.
I don't know why I had the Bad Seeds in my head, but that's what I typed it out. So my apologies for getting it wrong.
That's okay. I just noticed that. And, like, I love Nick Cave too. So there it is. But all that to say, like, I think it's not by accident. Like, all this stuff is very, I'm also a recording engineer. And so, like, there's a lot of angles to this. Like, I enjoy producing records. I listen to so much music all the time. And honestly, at this point, I don't know what my biggest influences are. It's a mess. Like, I just like music a lot. So
one of the things I miss about albums or even CDs to a large extent is I'm going through your albums and listening to them. I can't pull up the information that I want to read, like who produced it, who engineered it, where was it recorded, when was it recorded, how long did it take, who are your thank yous.
Tell you whatever you want to know if you have any questions. I got all of it, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you do. Let's go down the road. I'm go all the way back to the beginning. And Valencia, where was that recorded?
This is the funniest one to me. So the first record, well, let's even go before that. The first single was a single called Annie. The first EP and the first single and everything was recorded at Music Group in Edmond, which is this little, it's little, but it's great. Like, it's very clean, very pristine, a little too much so, but it was this little spot in Edmond. They do a lot of Christian contemporary music, a lot of stuff like that. But there's a friend of mine, I can't even remember how we were introduced, but his name is Bryce Sabrick. He was also in the military. And so he hooked me up and he did my first single for a bottle of Captain Morgan's rum. and he dug the music. And so he gave me a great deal. I think we cut the entire 5-song or 7-song EP for $600.
Wow.
super cheap. And it sounds pretty good. It's not,
it's really good.
There's not a lot of dirt in it. Like, it's pretty clean, even a little bit sterile, which is a part, like, that's on me too, because I didn't really, that was my first time, not my first time in a studio, but my first time doing my own project mm-hmm. in a studio. And so, yeah, super clean, super basic. The instruments sound exactly like what they sound like. Like, there's no crazy production or anything. And that was Bryce Zabrick at Music Group Studios.
Before I get to the second one, I want to push back a little bit on your age. You can't say you're only 28. I mean, you think about all these artists and what they accomplished in those early years. I mean, you're not only, you're 28. That's the age you are. Your body of work, there are people 48 who don't have the body of work that you have, and certainly the quality of work that you're doing. So
thank you. Sometimes I feel ancient and sometimes I feel really young, and I don't know. It's so, comparison is like the fucking thief of joy. So I'm trying not to think about it too much.
No, nor should you.
Especially in modern age and the way things are, everyone's expecting stuff over and over and over nonstop. And I like albums. I like sitting and listening to vinyls, but people want singles because they can't pay attention for too long. So I'm trying to split the difference.
And you're doing a great job. That was one of the questions I had for you, is because I see you're releasing, and you're releasing regularly, and you're not, it's almost an album a year for all intents and purposes up until what, 20? Yeah, till COVID. And since then, you've been releasing things regularly. And I think I'm of the age, I remember the albums. It's not like fucking foreign times. I don't think we're in an album age anymore. I think it's content. I think just release stuff when it's ready to be released. You can put together an album later, you know?
Yeah. And I did that, you know? Yeah. I did, you know, you might have seen in 2019, yeah, I'm sorry if I'm skipping ahead, but we did a single a month the entire year. That was the whole goal. And at the time, we didn't have a fan base, really. And so I was like, I have no idea how I'm going to afford this, but let's just set it as a goal and we'll figure it out. And it worked. Like, we got the fan base. The algorithm picked up what we were doing, and I got lucky, honestly.
Luck is part of it, certainly, but I think talent always rises above.
Oh, thank you. I liked that record specifically. I mean, that was a cool challenge to me, because, like, we were working. So, okay, skip ahead to One Big Beautiful Sound.
Yeah.
We did that with Taylor Johnson at Lunar Matter. At the time, so do you know Ackerman McQueen? It doesn't matter. They're an advertising agency, been around since the 70s. They had a studio in this bank, this 1970s build out, super amazing studio. That's where Taylor Johnson is now with Lunar Matter. Before that, he was in this little tiny room that had like an offshoot. And that's where we did every single song. It was like an 8x6 foot room. And then he had a mixing room on the side of it. Like, it wasn't big. But the thing there was, we would take groups of three. I would pick three songs. We would go in the studio over a weekend and we would knock them all out. And then we would have the next 3 months recorded so we could release a single a month. And then, you know, in that last month, we would go back in, record three more. But, like, every time we went in, I didn't, you know, I had the horn parts kind of, but I didn't really know what we were going to do. Like, I had the basics fleshed out, but there was a lot of production and stuff that happened in arrangement in that moment. And so they're not perfect. They're kind of messy. The production isn't great. Like, the mixing isn't awesome, but, like, I think it was really cool for what it was, because it was a challenge just to see, can we pump these songs out this frequently? And so, yeah, I think that helped us grow an audience. I don't want to do it again.
Did you find in that release cycle that with each release you grew and grew and grew and grew?
A little bit, yeah. And there was also, we did collaborations. We did a song with a YouTuber and that video took off. Mm-hmm. And that was in combination, like, in tandem with that, it kind of spiraled. That was in 2019.
Right.
And then in 2020, that record kind of marinated. And I was also doing, I took that time in the, you know, pandemic to do Patreon and YouTube videos and stuff like that. And so I think we definitely, our fan base, I think, identifies the brand of the band with that era of 2019, because it was just when we accrued the mass, like, the most of our fans. So
awesome.
But there's the bit for that. Taylor Johnson, Lunar Manor, for that record.
Now, Insomnia.
That one was all me. I recorded and mixed it at my studio, and it was a bitch. I will never do it again.
Why?
There's a few reasons. At the time, I wasn't very good. much better mix engineer than I was then. I learned a lot. I didn't have very good gear, whatever. There were some interesting arrangement moments. I definitely got ahead of myself in some ways. I brought in these big string sections and like clarinets, flutes, and all this stuff. And that was my, you could call it like my Sergeant Pepper moment. I think every band has one.
Absolutely.
And that was my bit where I was just like, let's throw everything at the wall and just do all that. The reason I will not record myself again, there's two big reasons. One is, I think that three big reasons. One big one, it's not as fun. Mostly because like if I am in control of everything to that extent and there are no surprises and I am, it's kind of like if you see the entire process and then you see the end product, you see the end product for all of its mistakes. But if you are not involved and you take a step back and then you get like that, you get finally to hear the end product, like you can appreciate it for what it is. And so just for the sake of this being enjoyable for me, that's important. And then two, yeah, just the art of collaboration with other people, like actually having somebody else to weigh in is, you know, invaluable. Like you don't have to be an auteur or whatever, create this in a vacuum and have complete control. Like it's not worth it to say that you did it just to do it, because you're not going to enjoy it as much and it's not going to be as good, most likely. I think, like, even if you're the greatest, you know, greatest writer or artist in the world, like if you pair up with the right producer, the right engineer, it's going to be better. And you just don't have to wear all the hats. Like it's, yeah. And then third, it's impossible to say I'm done, really. If you're the mix engineer and it's your project and your face and your name and everything, you are never finished. It's impossible to hit that complete button. And I was mixing and over mixing and remixing over and over again on that Insomnia record. And I was just like, I never want to do this again. I will pay somebody to do this.
Is that why you called it Insomnia? Because you didn't sleep during the making of the record?
No, actually. So that was inspired. The first song I wrote for it was Insomnia, which was maybe one of our least popular songs, but I liked it a lot. I never play it live. I never, you know, it's whatever, but I was on Wellbutrin and lithium, and I was on all this medication for bipolar, and I had not stopped drinking, which is not what you're supposed to do. And so I had these blackouts, and I was experiencing like really weird things. And there was a period where I was up for somewhere around 90 to 94 hours. I just wasn't able to sleep. And it got to the point where I was like kind of going insane, because I wanted to. I just like, I had really fucked up my circadian rhythm. I just messed myself up. There was also, I took Adderall and a bunch of stuff. I really messed myself up. There was definitely a time where I used substances a lot.
I'm with you. I hear all of those drugs. I recognize all of the drugs. I'm with you.
And so like literally that I wrote the song like on the fourth day of just being awake. I wrote Insomnia, and it was just this like fever dream thing. I don't know.
Manning everything yourself and never hitting that finish button. I write as well. And you can edit yourself into a state of paralysis, or you can edit the feeling and emotion out of anything that you're creating. If you got it too much, did you find yourself running across that?
I ran into a different problem. And that's like Rick Rubin has a phrase for, he calls it demoitis. I don't over edit. I don't do that normally. But one thing that I will do is I will get very tied to the demo and the way that I wrote it that way. And that in itself is kind of a box that's not good, which is why like lately I've been intentionally, and it drives me crazy, but I've been intentionally underwriting songs. And just like, because I think like any good song, you know, it should be a good song without all the frills and stuff. Like if I take something and I play it with the vocals and the piano, it should be a good song still. And so if I've got something and I know that it's good at that, I won't touch it anymore. Eventually it's going to come time for me to do another record. I'll come back to it and then I'll play with it. And then it's time to edit and stuff. But I've never been in a situation personally where I've over edited something into oblivion. I only demo something at the base level now, the most like empirical version of that. And then I step away from it. And I think that the act of stepping away from it allows for that. What is that? There's a phrase for it. The type of inspiration that hits very suddenly, that lightning in the bottle.
Spontaneous.
I suppose, like, you know what I mean?
I get it. Lightning in a bottle.
Yeah. And if you step away from a song enough, when you come back to it, and you can almost listen to it as a passive observer instead of the writer, then I think you can start producing it, and then you might not over edit that way. Now, if you write it and then you keep messing with it, then I think you could totally do that. But like taking that step away from it, it helps with that. I think. I also, you know, like I said, I'm a recording engineer and I produce other people's records, and like it is part of my job sometimes to tell people that we are done. Like we've done. Yeah. Like we need to stop stacking.
Yeah. Do you find that easier to do with other artists than you do for yourself?
Yes. But like I said, like that's the reason why I have stopped, why I demo something and then forget about it. And I try not to succumb to that demoitis thing, because like I was saying, like if you separate yourself enough from it, you can come back to it later. Like I got some demos that I haven't heard in a year. I can listen to them as like a passive observer. And as if I've never heard it, like I literally force myself to forget about it so that it's new to me. And then I can produce it like I would anybody else's stuff. But yeah, it requires you to have like no love for any one song. Like, especially if I think I've got something really good, I will forget about it. I'll push it away and I won't think about it as much as I can.
I think as a creative person, you have to be, you can't be too precious about things, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you just can't be too precious, I don't think.
And that's also, that is something I learned with We Did Not Ask for This Room, our last that we put out. So I've always written all the music, but like for that one, I was especially exacting, I guess. I was very specific about what I wanted things to sound like production wise. And I had all the horn parts written out in sheet music. Like we had everything rehearsed to a T. And so we went into the studio and we just did it. Part by part, like there really wasn't much room for experimentation.
How do you feel that turned out?
So it's good, I think, but I don't enjoy listening to it anymore.
Really?
Yeah. And it's because I took the fun out of it for me, I think. I think that I have much less value in saying I did it exactly how I wanted. I don't think it's actually very valuable to get exactly what you're asking for. Like when you're creating something or making a record, like I want to be surprised. I want there to be moments in it where there are like aha moments and fun things. Like that's the thing about like music, is it's something to be done with other people. Even if you are the main songwriter and you're doing all this, opening up avenues for expression from the people that you're working with in the studio and the other musicians, like it's only going to make the music better. I mean, you have to know what your hard limits are and you have to kind of rein things in here and there, but like too much control from one person. And again, not to say that it's bad. Like if you like the record, I appreciate that. That's awesome. And a lot of people do. I don't like listening to it. And so the question is like, if I'm going to do this, I have to remember the reason why I do music in the first place, because I love it and I like listening to it. It's fun. And like, I've discovered that's not the way to do it for me. Even though it yields a good album and stuff, I would rather, what's the word? Collaborate is what I'm saying. Yeah.
No.
The system won't let me do that.
Okay. Yeah, no, fine. One boba, please. We'll call it a mental health day treat. Self-care, right? Isn't that what people call it whenever they need an excuse to do whatever the fuck they want?
I don't know.
Yeah, no, of course you don't. Of course you don't.
What I found on We Didn't Ask for This Room, there's a crunchier sound to it. And there's a big mixing of genre. I heard a blend of genres. You know, I heard a little bit of ska on The Clock. I heard Sade on We, and I don't know where I pulled that from. And you have probably, if you've been to the dentist, then you've heard a Sade song. So, but she's an old, from the 80s. But it's just melodically, that's what it kind of reminded me of. So I heard a lot of different things. I heard a lot of different genres going into that record. One of the reasons I really enjoyed it.
My favorite thing about that record, and it was extraordinarily intentional. One reason why I would call it a success in my eyes is like I sought out to do one very specific thing with it because we had done Valencia and Insomnia and One Beautiful Sound. And for the most part, it was this sort of jazzy, poppy, alternative like thing. Like I had carved out a very specific sound and I wanted to do other stuff. Like I love Radiohead. I love fucking Cigaros. And I listen to Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails. And I go all over the place with that stuff. And I was just like, if I can, that's also why the album is 17 songs, is I was like, if I can make a record where I go all over the place, and if people can accept that, and they're not too put off by it, then that will give me the freedom to pretty much do anything. Because this record goes enough places that it kind of opens doors to other... It's basically, I put a thing out saying, like, here's like a couple things that I would like to do. Is that cool with you all? And for the most part, everyone seemed to take to it. So I think the last record was really just what I had to do in order for this new record to exist.
Right.
And the next one. You know, like, I want to keep... making, I don't want the next record to sound like the last one too much. Like I want to keep messing around. It's supposed to be fun for me. Again, at the end of the day, that's why I do this, is because I like it and it's my expression and stuff. And so
on One Big Beautiful Sound, the two songs I liked were All Right and You Want a Song,
which I get, those were my favorites.
It seems we circled back around, as if we never even left at all. What are we to say? What have we to say, if anything at all? I guess us and we could just pretend as if we never missed a moment. But why do we lie? Why do we try and act like we don't care? A couple messages to start.
I would be remiss if I didn't single out The Replacements, because you say you're 28, and I'm curious how they impacted you.
There was like a time when I was around 8 or 9, and there was a big influx of music, and they were one of the bands that I was made aware of at that time. And that's because when I was eight or nine, my mom was dating this other woman who is basically my second mom, Phoebe, and she was kind of a punk. She listened to a totally different kind of like strain of music. She introduced me to The Descendants and The Refreshments and The Replacements and Bad Brains and Dead Kennedy and Rage Against the Machine and like all this stuff. Dead Kennedys. But yeah, like I think the first song I ever heard was Bastards of Young, which has nothing to do with the band name, but I do love that song. I think that's my favorite. But like, yeah, I don't know. I lumped them in with all those other bands because I was exposed to this mass intake of music all at once. But yeah, I think that's, if I could pick one song that summarizes them for me, that would be it for sure.
We are the sons of no one. Did you grow up in Oklahoma?
I grew up a bunch of places. I partially in like Fort Campbell, in like Tennessee, Kentucky, and then Oklahoma. But yeah, most of my life been here, all over the state. And then I've been in like Oklahoma City proper since I was like 14.
Do you have any siblings? Do you come from a musical family?
No siblings. My family's not necessarily musical. My dad played guitar a little bit. He still sort of does. He was a metalhead. My parents were 16 when I was born. And so I've talked about that a little bit before, because I think that's why I adopted some of their music tastes. Normally there's such an age gap between kids and their parents that they don't really cross over. But like, you know, when I was like 5, my mom was 20, like 21. So like, it's just not that far off. Like they were 16 in 1995. And so all that music they were listening to is what I eventually grabbed onto. Like I had all their Case Logic books of CDs and stuff. Like, and so that they weren't really musical, but they were definitely music fans. Like, absolutely. So
are they still?
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. My dad mostly listens to metal, but he did introduce me to like Misfits and Danzig and Rancid, and he listened to some stuff like that. Slayer too. I grew up listening to metal. I think my favorite band when I was a kid, for a while, my favorite drummer was Joey Jordison from Slipknot.
Wow. Okay.
I don't know where, because I was a drummer first. That was my first instrument.
Okay.
And somewhere along the line, like I said, when Phoebe came along, it was like tons of music, and it broke away into other things. Cause my mom was a huge, she listened to like Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson. And she was like a goth pagan chick when she was a teenager. So
I think everyone has that one person that opens their mind up musically. You know, sometimes it's a sibling, sometimes it's a partner, sometimes it's, you know, there's always, what do we call them? It's almost like a drug dealer. Enabler. The music enabler.
The gateway.
Yeah. If you like this, then you'll like this type of thing.
You know, Phoebe was definitely that for me. And she was so cool. She is so cool, but she was like, I swear, she wore like those leather jackets with the studs, and she had patches all over her jacket and shit. And like, I remember like when I first turned 16 and I got my first car, I remember my very first show was at this place called the Brass Bell. And it was a little like local DIY punk show. And like, that's where my first like shows that I ever went to were definitely like DIY punk shows. And those were my favorite. Like this band, Johnny Manchild, it is not a punk band at all. However, the feeling and the crowd and the vibe, like the people that I see and that I've gotten to meet on tour and stuff, it's similar. Because if you ever go to a punk show, it's not really, the music is one thing, but the vibe is a whole other thing. Like it's really a communal experience. Like it's very, it's the weirdos all in one place, and it's just a comfortable place to be. And our shows have gotten to be that. And I realized, like, through touring, like, we're not a punk band, but the feeling of it and, like, the way that the shows go, like, it's closer to that than anything else for me. Like, that identity of that makes so much sense. Yeah, without all the political anthems and all that. But, like, yeah, we bring out the weirdos because we are weirdos, and it's a comfortable place for them to be. And
it's like a revival gathering of sorts, like a Pentecostal gathering or something.
Yeah.
Without the religion stuff, you know.
Punk shows are about the people, and it's about the crowd. Like, it definitely is. It's the same as jazz. You can listen to jazz on CD as much as you want, but if you don't go see it live, you don't understand.
Yeah. I was on a date. I lived in the city at the time. Are you familiar with Smalls, the jazz club in New York?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I was like, oh, this will be cool. I'll take her to Smalls. And we had dinner, and then we went to the jazz club. It's in the basement, some brownstone. And it's very crowded. It's very cramped. And we have a nice little table. And they start playing. And I think we paid $20 each to get in. And she looks at me, and I look at her, and she's like, do you want to go? I'm like, yeah, let's go. So we split, and oddly enough, we got our money back. We were only in there for like 15 minutes, and the bouncer was kind enough to give us our money back. And so my feelings for jazz, I think, are somewhat akin to punk. I miss it. I just,
see, my experience of Smalls is such a radically different story.
Tell me about it.
Well, I was, the first time I was in New York, I want to say I was 20. And I was 21, but barely, if I was. And I was in the jazz program. Like, I was in the middle of, like, my most, I practiced all the time, every day. Like, I was super, super into it. I was like the jazz nerd of jazz nerds at the time, like, really practicing my ass off. And, like, I didn't know what Smalls was. Or, like, I had heard of it, but I didn't know where it was. I didn't know anything about it. And I was just in New York with friends, and I was absolutely shit-faced, just like walking down the street, like with a slice of pizza, like having a great time. And literally I hear music, and I'm just like, what is that? And I'm just like following the music drunk. All my friends are just kind of following me because they're like, yeah, sure, let's go. And we find Smalls. I walk down this staircase, and I'm at Smalls, and there's this band just tearing it, just like absolutely shredding. The place is empty, which I didn't realize. I know. I didn't know better at the time to realize how insane that was. It was like 1 a.m. and it was empty. And yeah, just these phenomenal players just tearing it up. And that was my first introduction to Smalls. It was almost like a religious experience. Yeah. 'Cause first I was only 21. I was super into jazz. And so I was the target demographic for that place.
Certainly, especially, well, yeah. And being buzzed helps.
Oh, way past buzzed. Like, I wanted to sit in, but I was too drunk to do it. And I was terrified because, like, it's one thing to be somebody listening and at a jazz club and having a good time. It is an entirely other thing to sit in during the jam sessions. Cause, like, you know, they do their show, and then usually late at night, they'll open it up for people to sit in with the band.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's a pretty common thing. You won't find it at like BB King's or something like that. But like at most jazz clubs, like around 2 or 3 a.m, they'll open it up because, you know, any jazz musician knows standards. They can sit in and play. But it's scary. If you're from Oklahoma and you're in New York City, it's scary.
I would imagine, yeah. At what point did you decide you wanted to be a musician? When did you, and sub question here, or adjacent question, you were in the service.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your service. I appreciate it.
I was in the band. It was nothing.
Hey, you know, plenty of people did time in the band, still in the service.
Yeah. Basic training was fun. It's the same for everybody, I guess. So, but yeah, I have always done music. My earliest memory of music was, I think I was like 4. And I don't know if you've ever seen those little Tykes drums, like the yellow ones, the red and yellow ones with the red sticks attached by strings. And I was playing along to The Beautiful People by Marilyn Manson. That's the first thing I remember playing. But I had been on like Ritalin as a 5-year-old, and it was not good for me. And so instead, my parents kind of saw that I was interested in, you know, tapping around in music and stuff. And so they got me a little drum set. And then by the time I was eight, there we go.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I was eight, I started taking lessons. And like, there was never, I don't remember there ever being a time where I asked if it's what I wanted to do, or I said it, or if anybody asked me or anyone made me do anything. It's just, it was what I was doing and I liked doing it. And I, it's just been that way. Like, it was just what I do, I guess.
Hmm.
Yeah. I've always liked
it. That's awesome.
I had my mom's little Walkman when I was a kid. And I remember just like, I would listen to everything. Like, I think my first CD, the first couple things I ever listened to was Livin' La Vida Loca by Ricky Martin, the Marshall Mathers LP.
Wow.
40 Ounces to Freedom. Like, Sublime. Like, that was just some of the CDs my parents had. And I remember listening to those a bunch. And I think eventually it started to spread out. But like, oh, and Spit by Kitty. I was really into that.
Never even heard of that.
They were an all-female metal band.
Got to make a note of that. The first thing I remember liking, the first album I bought with my own money, was Elton John's Greatest Hits, Volume 1.
I have two things about that, actually. The first, I do remember the first CD I ever bought with my own money. And that was From Here to the Infirmary by Alkaline Trio.
Wow.
Loved that record. Wow. That, and then I think shortly after it was Coral Fang by the Distillers.
Wow.
I also loved them. I was a huge Brody Dahl fan. But speaking of Elton John, piano people, going back to Ben Folds, mm-hmm. my first introduction to, you know, piano alternative, piano rock, that kind of thing, it happened before I even knew. I didn't find out until I was 15 that I had been listening to Ben Folds since I was six, because Ben Folds had a song called Lonely Christmas Eve on Jim Carrey's The Grinch Who Stole Christmas record, which that was my favorite song. And I had no idea it was Ben Folds until I got back into him in my teens. But yeah, like, that one had been marinating for a while.
And as far as Christmas goes, thank you for now. You have now written my new favorite Christmas song.
It's Coldest Spot Outside.
Yes. I was like, wow, I'm not much for Christmas. And I love that song. So thank you for that.
Of course. You've got to check out Cyndi Lauper and The Hives. They did a song called A Christmas Duet, and it's fantastic.
Really? I always encourage people to write a Christmas song, because it's going to get played every year.
Every year. It's like Mariah Carey getting thawed out. Like, it's funny.
You started on drums. Well, let me ask you this. What instruments do you play?
Drums, piano, bass, guitar.
Okay. What's your primary interest? Jesus. What's your primary instrument outside of your voice?
It's piano.
Piano. Okay.
And I've never considered myself a singer, but I'm trying. Like, I'm trying to get better, and I keep trying to get better. I consistently write things that are outside of my ability. It is hilarious to me to hear people, they consider me a singer. They like how my voice sounds, or they think people ask me questions about it, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. And the fact that you think it's impressive is insane to me, but I'm going to roll with it as hard as I can.
As you should. It means you're doing something right.
I'm all character and no technique, I think.
A lot of people have made it with far less than that, you know? What are your career aspirations?
I want to do what I'm doing, honestly. Like, I've realized I was really scared before I went. So I'll talk about last year a little bit, just to dig into this. I feel like every time you ask a question, I go on a tangent, and I apologize for that. But speaking of career aspirations, last year, actually, I believe 2 weeks ago was the 1 year anniversary from when I went to a mental hospital again, which is cool. But I have some issues. I had a little psychotic break, you might call it. And it was right before we left on the 6 week tour. And so I was in the psych ward for 6 days, and then I get out, and about a month later, I was supposed to leave. I booked this entire 6 week house show tour myself, which 6 weeks is a long time to be gone straight. Mm-hmm. And we were all over the East Coast, through Canada, like all that. And so I got to thinking a lot while I was in the hospital, like, what am I doing? Like, do I had to question, like, do I enjoy music? or am I wrapped up in the momentum of what I'm doing? And I questioned a lot. Do I actually like what I'm doing anymore? Am I going to be able to go on these tours? Am I up to it? Is this, you know, what if I'm not the kind of person that enjoys this? Like, not everyone's made to tour. It is a lot of work and it is grueling and mentally taxing sometimes. And I was very happy to find I loved it. I absolutely loved it. The moment that I was in the van, I had 6 straight weeks with no anxiety, no depression, no questions about anything. Like, everything is so clear when you're on the road. Like, your goals are so clear. You know, you go to a new city, you meet these people, you play a show, everybody has a good time, ideally, or there's no one there and you just get to jam out. Either way, and you're seeing the world, you're traveling, and that is what I want. Like, that is for sure my aim in this career, is like, I love touring, I love meeting people, and like the communal aspect of music. And, you know, I've got to hear so many cool stories from different people, and not including like even the bands that we get to play with and the other musicians that I get to meet, and what you're exposed to and what your influences come from when you're on the road. Like, you see another band that kicks ass and you're like, why can't we do that? And then you go down this whole other avenue. And like, it is a similar feeling to when I was in the thick of college. And it's something that a lot of people don't realize until they're out of college, is that you are surrounded by a bunch of people in the thick of this thing. Like, you can go down the hall and you can be talking to somebody about 1680 Italian opera librettos. And then you can go down the hall and someone's talking about Coltrane's like music theory and his pentatonic, whatever the fuck. And there's all this going on. It's the same way out on the road, is you've got all these bands operating at a high level, all trying to perform their best. They're all on their own grind, their own kick. Like, I think it's just something about that. That's my career goal, is to be performing at a high level, constantly learning as much as I can, and being surrounded by people who are doing the same thing. I think that's the best I can put it. Like, I ideally make some money while I'm doing it, but like, that's really what it is.
Since you opened it up, I'm going to ask, how do you think mental health informs your creativity?
A lot. I just wrote a song called Medicine Dance, which is what it is. You know, for anybody that's ever had to, let's take insurance and cost out of the equation, just trying to find the right combination of medications, because it's out there supposedly. But, you know, I've taken bupropion and like it's Seroquel and lithium and Prozac and olanzapine and Prazosin and all this stuff. Like, you try all this shit and it's, first of all, even if let's say it is the right thing, that's good and great. But if it's not, now you fucked up your brain a little bit more. Now you got to recover, go back from that. Like, you keep just messing with your mental chemistry over and over again. And then best case scenario, you get it right. Right now I'm on a pretty good concoction of Prozac and some other stuff, and it is very helpful, but it is hard to write. It has changed my creative process, because normally, you know, my bipolar disorder does kind of affect me. It's in my low points is usually when I'll write the most, and then on my upswings is usually when I have the energy and the mindset to actually, you know, demo and record and, you know, kind of shape it a little bit. But when you're healthy, like I'm, you know, a lot more even keel right now, but it does make it difficult. I have to kind of redesign how I do things, and it is worth it because I know myself off the medication. And so, yeah, there is a balance. It affects it. Absolutely. And it's something I'm probably always going to be working with and against, like, forever.
Yeah, I mean, I have my own battles with it. Not bipolar, but depression. I've dealt with it my entire fucking life. I like to joke that I was probably depressed in utero. You know,
it's just as complicated.
It's a matter of finding the cocktail that works for you.
Just last month, like early December, I was like, I don't like this. I can't write. I'm feeling bland. It's affecting my life. Like, and so I just stopped. I cold turkeyed all my drugs. And if anyone out there is considering that, who happens to be listening to this, don't do that. Because, I mean, the mental thing is one thing, but the physical response to being, to cold turkeying a drug you've been on for 14 months, I got to learn really close what brain zaps were.
What brain what?
Brain zaps.
What are those?
They used to think that they were mini seizures, but they're not, because that's kind of what they feel like. They're, my girlfriend describes it as like, imagine if you like died in a video game and you respawned. Like, there's just a moment where you're just like, and then you're back. Like, it's literally this like zap. And it's this, it's an SSRI thing. It happens when you cold turkey SSRIs. They don't know what causes it, but I'll tell you, it sucks. Like, I would be driving and just be like, ugh, and have to like recalibrate my entire body. But anyway, point is, I think like these things are difficult. There is a long history of people with mental disorders, and bipolar specifically, who say that their medications dull them. And there's a really good quote. I don't know if it was Freud or something, but somebody says like creativity or genius lies just over the border of madness or something like that. And like, it's nice to think that way and it's kind of romantic, but like in all reality, like I'm going to die if I don't stay on my meds. Like, I am not safe for myself. And so you have to realize like these things aren't going to make it perfect, but I think there is a, they're meant to get you closer to the middle of the road so that you can take the steps you need to get the rest of the way. And so with that same train of thinking, you know, okay, it's not going to be the same creatively. I'm not going to have the same process. That doesn't mean I can't do it. I just don't know how yet.
Correct.
And I have to relearn that. And that's kind of where I'm at right now is, and this is one thing that's nice about being a producer. I do my job just fine with other people's music. And I get results that work. And so I just have to learn how to channel that. It's kind of like having a crush versus actual love. Like, one is really flashy and it's really nice and it's really big and spontaneous and fireworks and everything, but it's not necessarily real. Chances are actually it's going to be a lot more special to you than it is to anybody else. It doesn't actually mean that it's great, but like the thing that you actually put time into and you work towards in the everyday thing, like building your skill set, like understanding, I don't know. There's a million ways to write a song. I've never been the guy to take like a template or like really sit down and hash out a song, but that's not to say I couldn't. That's not to say maybe someday I take a storytelling approach, or, you know, there's a million ways to be creative and to approach this thing. And I'm going to figure out what my next thing is, but yeah, I'm in the middle of it right now, figuring out.
Good. Glad to hear you say all of that. I find it extremely important and admirable that people like yourself and King Iso, I interviewed a couple of weeks ago, they speak openly about mental illness. I keep it pretty close to the chest. I might not even leave this part in, because but I think it's so important to speak openly about it, because it takes away some of the stigma attached to it. The more we talk about it.
I'll say this. I had an experience. So that's something, this band has changed who I am as a person.
Good.
Because I'll say this, when I started this band, I was in another band as the bass player and I was the backup singer and I was writing songs for the band. They used a couple of mine and they kind of ripped me off. They took my songs and they, you know, submitted them to ASCAP as writers and stuff, and they kind of fucked me over a little bit and I ended up quitting the band. And it was such a bad experience when I quit the band. Like, everyone quit the band, but because we all agreed to do it together because it was such shit. But like, I had such a bad experience. I was like, fuck this. I've got songs. Obviously, they're good enough if people want to take them. And so I started this band, Johnny Manchild. But at the time, I was not a performer. I had never been. And I had never sang like that. I had never been the front man of a band before. I was always the drummer or the bassist or something else. And I decided to do it. And I threw up before every goddamn show for like the first 3.5 years because I was so nervous. And I definitely drank before shows. There was a time where I did that because like it was the only way I could chill out enough to do it. And eventually I got over that. But like, in the process of doing this band, a couple things have happened. One, I got over that anxiety and that performance anxiety, and I learned to enjoy it. Another thing is the brand of this band has sort of become, maybe just naturally, transparency. Like, it's something, I am extremely transparent about my past and my history and what the songs are about and just everything. And that has been because, one, because it's kind of like a therapeutic thing for me, but also because it's what I get back from the fans. Like, it's this open dialogue that's going on where people feel comfortable enough to talk to me about these things. And I do battle with the concept of, like, I don't necessarily owe them anything. That's not how this works. But, like, I have the right to my own privacy. But at the same time, it is a very cool thing having this communication. Like, that's the thing about music. It's relatability and bringing people together and having something that you can talk about and relate to others with. And there's a moment, two big things on that 6-week tour, that first big tour that we went on, where I realized, like, how important that was. One of them was I had a fan come up to me and say that this was their 1-year anniversary of their hormone therapy. And I was just like, first of all, like, the fact that you chose to spend that with me here at this show is amazing. The fact that you're comfortable telling me that, and that you don't feel like this, like, just the fact that this is that we create this vibe and these shows where people are comfortable enough to express that is amazing. And it's made me more comfortable expressing myself, because it's just a good vibe. And I think that's really important. And then the other thing, there is this dad, did not expect this at all. The last person in the world I expected this from, but he came up to me after the show. And he was like, you know, I really appreciate you talking about, because I talk about this kind of stuff at shows sometimes. I tell people what the songs are about. And he comes up, he's like, you know, I've been on this medication for depression recently. I went, like, my whole life kind of not believing in it. And, you know, I'm dealing with my own mental stuff. And it's nice to hear you talk about, you know, it's been kind of an issue with my family, like, and my kids and everything. And it's become something that everyone can kind of, I don't know, it's an open conversation that somehow makes it all feel better. Like, it doesn't have to be this weird taboo fucked up thing. And we can all talk about mental health, and we can share our experiences with it, how to get better. Like, it does make the whole thing a little better. Like, it's just good. I don't know. It's a good feeling. Those are the reasons why I don't think I could ever quit doing this, is because it's such a good, like, human thing that's happening.
I keep my distance out of deference, it happens of course. The frequency of this is dominating every discourse. I understand by God, by the challenge, but to who it is I. The common sense is rancid, senseless realization I find. I'm growing tired, uninspired by the current bitch. It grows and feeds like a disease until I bleed from the itch. Unearthing each and every hollow body, raising knowledge. The ways of all are new and bold, and we are covered by it.
I loved the video for "Oh Songbird."
Thanks.
But yeah, I don't know who's behind that, but I like the juxtaposition of playing in front of a barn when you're clearly not barn type music. I loved your outfit. I thought that was great. I don't know. The shirt was amazing. And the end, I just got goosebumps. The end, I'm not going to spoil it for anyone because I think you should watch it, but the end was just perfect.
Thank you.
tell me about the concept of that.
You know, we actually got in trouble for that.
Okay.
I don't want to say, just in case I can't, whose theater that was.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be another person's theater, and they, like, jumped up my ass about being there, and they were talking about lawyers and all this. And so the sign in the back that says Johnny Manchild,
mm-hmm.
I'll just say that's not what it said in real life. And our videographer is a very talented VFX artist.
Okay.
So I don't even want to put that onto the universe by saying who this is, but God, they made my life a fucking pain.
That's uncool.
Ultimately, though, looks a lot cooler saying Johnny Manchild.
Absolutely. So the new album drops on March 22nd. You spent 5 days tracking the record?
In total, 6, because we had an additional day for horns.
Okay.
back in Oklahoma. We recorded the horns with Michael Trepanier at Cardinal Song Studio, which he is the definition of audiophile when it comes to an engineer. He is scientific and precise, which when it comes to doing live horns is great. That's what you want.
You've mentioned a couple of other favorites. Do you have a favorite song on the new album?
It's been really difficult, but right now it is between Beyond Me and Everything Stays. Mm. Fake Me Out is also up there. It's really, that's our single coming out this Friday.
Okay.
And that one's pretty cool, but like something about Beyond Me is a super tramp song, essentially. Like I wanted to do Bloody Well Out.
Okay.
I wanted to go that way.
It's rare that you hear Super Tramp name checked. Rare.
I love Super Tramp. They're great, you know? But yeah, like, I mean, if you like Steely Dan, Super Tramp's right there.
No, for sure. For sure.
But yeah, I wanted a song like that, which you could say Benny and the Jets, sure, but, and most people will say that. But what it really is Bloody Well Right. If you're going to say that I'm stealing, that's what I'm stealing from. And I love it. I just wanted something with lots of space and something groovy. And then Everything Stays. I was listening to a lot of Spoon.
Hmm.
And it goes a little more that way. It's guitar driven. Lyrically, it is my favorite song on the record. So I'll say that.
You have so much ahead of you, man.
I try not to, I don't want to tell myself like this is going to be awesome and blow up and do something, but I hope that it gets me a few steps forward for sure.
It seems like your career has been going that way.
It's really hard to tell when you're in my position. I'll just say that. You know, and it has. Like, I'm so grateful for what this is. Like, because I recognize, like, I am, me 4 years ago would be shitting his pants this is where I'm at. And I have to recognize that a lot of people aren't this lucky to, like, this is what I do for a living. You know, I have to do engineer work here and there, but for the most part, this pays my bills, which is insane on its own to be a musician.
Yeah, that's really lucky.
It's a big deal. And so it's why I love doing this. And that's why, like, when you say that, when you ask me, like, what I want to do or what my aim for my career is, like, I'm there. Like, it's this close. And, like, I know that it's never going to be a big jump, but I just try and I'm trying to tweak it little by little as we go. And I don't know. I think this record will be good. I enjoy it very much. I think a lot of people will like it, and I hope that a lot of people get to hear it. I don't know. We'll see what fucking happens.
Johnny, I've taken up so much of your time. Thank you. I love the album. I love your work, and I wish you so much success as you're moving forward. I have no doubt that it'll find you.
Well, I really appreciate it. I put, you know, a lot of effort into this one. I'm already thinking about the next one. So I hope this one lets me do something even cooler next time.
Thanks, Johnny. I really appreciate it. Take care, man.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye.
Many thanks to Johnny for taking time out to talk with us. The band's new album, Rapture Waltz, drops on March 22nd. He's currently on tour, so check out his website, manchild.band, for a date near you. Extra special thanks to Dana Gordon at Indie Music Media.
This episode of Abandoned Albums was written and produced by Keith R. Higgins. The show was recorded at Thunderlove Studio, where it was engineered by
Daphne Morris,
with help from
John Thomas.
Abandoned Albums was edited by
Mike Hunt.
Our theme song is Booty Cooler by Shuggy Otis. In the opening of the show, the songs you heard were Rumble by Link Ray, 16 Tons by Tennessee Ernie Ford, and the Carpenters classic Top of the World, performed by Shonen Knife. You can stream all of those songs and artists wherever you stream your favorite music.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
The songs you heard during this podcast were Johnny Manchild and the Poor Bastards' new single So Much Better, from their forthcoming album, Rapture Waltz. You also heard Insomnia off their album by the same name, We from We Did Not Ask for This Room, All Right from One Big Beautiful Sound, and lastly, Oh Songbird, also off the upcoming Rapture Waltz. You can stream Johnny Manchild and the Poor Bastards wherever you stream your favorite music. Please remember to support independent artists.
If you like what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. Thanks for listening.
Grazie. Bailey Leaf. Rob Janicki. Mike Pellegrino. Therina Vella. Ronnie Barnett. S.W. Loudon. Michael Janicki, Peyton Janicki, and our executive producer.
This is Thunderwolf.
Abandoned Albums receives funding from Damon Pharmaceuticals, the makers of Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck is the only chewable tablet made to combat stomach unease associated with mediocrity. Taken daily, Ben Affleck can help combat explosive gastrointestinal shame. You can find a multitude of flavors in the incontinence section of your local pharmacy. Ben Affleck, save yourself the embarrassment.
The side effects include dry mouth, headache, anal leakage, muscle soreness, bad decisions, gender confusion, constipation, evil spirit possession, and banality. Use only as directed.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Pawprint Media.
And now, a word from our sponsor.